So this is the end of it. And the one thing I'd known all along, from the time when we started talking about what we would do and how we would put this together and which works we would look at, I knew I wanted to do Revelation. I was certain of. And I knew I wanted it to come at the end, but I didn't know why. And in the last couple of days, it's come clear to me why this is where we must end. We talked about Flannery O'Connor 3 years ago, and I'm not going to go through the story of her life again, other than to say we're ending up with a great Catholic writer, and ending up with a great Catholic story, and ending up with a great piece of literature, but we're ending up in a place rather different from the other major works of literature, particularly modern literature, that we've been looking at in the past few days. There were things different about the lady all along, from her peculiar life, the illness, being crippled up with lupus, her removal from the world in one sense, living most of her life on that farm in Georgia, the little farm in Georgia, where she and her mother, who loved each other, drove each other crazy, which is how it often is with those we love. Her devotion to peacocks, her walking around on those crutches, and writing these extraordinary stories. I mean, it was quite unusual. And in fact, it will be 35 years ago next week on August 3rd that she died. So it's something of a little anniversary even at this point. And it's time to do her some homage. What is unusual about this story is that it takes us back to a kind of Catholic art that is very old-fashioned, extremely old-fashioned. When Catholic art emerged out of the Mass in the early Middle Ages, when the drama came forward, when visual arts came forward, what much of that art was doing was trying to explain basic Christian principles and stories to the Catholic populace. When those plays were first put on, first in the sanctuary and then on the steps of the cathedrals, they simply told stories from Scripture. And it was another way of letting people understand what those stories were. Was a way of teaching, but there was the delight of having them presented imaginatively. One of the earliest musical compositions we have, it's called The Play of Daniel, and it's a telling of the story of Daniel in music and song and dance and dramatically. So that all along, one thing Christian art has done is to simply put forward Scripture, put forward the Gospel, put forward Catholic truths. What has happened and what we've seen in literature from the time of Hamlet is that these truths have gotten very complex. They've become more difficult to discuss. In Hamlet, they have become ambiguous. In Dostoevsky, they've had to go underground and be presented in an anti-heroic way. In the moviegoer, they're there, but they can hardly even be spoken of. The difficulty of presenting this truth in art has grown, although the truth, as we've seen, still can be presented. And now we can sit back, take a deep breath, and just go back to the beginning again, and with sheer joy, with clarity of purpose, with absolute delight and imagination and creativity, we've got Flannery O'Connor, the Catholic artist, doing what those Catholic artists did centuries ago, presenting something open, direct. This is not ambiguous. This is not troubled and tortured. This is not something that we have to dig into to get complex meaning. This is a Catholic truth presented boldly, openly, straightforwardly, but with imagination, style, wit, and genuine feeling so that we can experience it in a new way, perhaps feel it differently than we have in the past, and understand in a way that we haven't understood before. But what the story of Revelation is simply a presentation of a moment from the Gospel of St. Luke. She is not doing it as in the parable that our Lord told, but she is reenacting it by placing it in a modern context, in a modern setting, and in a way that will touch us more directly. That is something we can more easily understand. And at the same time, she's giving us a little bit of a surprise at the end. Let me read for you the parable. This is chapter 18 of St. Luke. Two men went up into the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee and the other a publican. The Pharisee standing prayed thus with himself, O God, I give thee thanks that I am not as the rest of men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, as also is this publican. I fast twice in a week, give tithes of all that I possess. And the publican, standing afar off, would not so much as lift his eyes towards heaven, but struck his breast, saying, O God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I say to you, this man went down into his house justified rather than the other, because everyone that exalteth himself shall be humbled, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. We're going to get that Pharisee and that publican turned into one woman. And there's going to be a moment of crisis that changes her from one into the other. But what we're going to see is that gospel story acted out before us in a way we can understand. We might say that Flannery O'Connor's Revelation opens in the modern temple. That's the doctor's office. There's no getting around it. Modern man, particularly in America, worships doctors. Those doctors will save us. Those doctors are there to cure us. There's another way in which we can say it's something she knew very well. Diseased all her life, suffering from lupus, in and out of the hospital, she knew what doctors' waiting rooms were like. So this is also being given to us by someone with a realistic eye who is recreating what goes on in a doctor's waiting room in the South in the late 50s. She knew it very well. But there is another sense in which all of us are sitting in the waiting room. This earth itself is a big waiting room. We all have our problems. There is something wrong with all of us. And the moment will come when we are given the diagnosis, okay? We're waiting to see the doctor. And there's a way in which that waiting room is simply a vision of where we all are, where we are passing our time. But our central figure is Mrs. Ruby Turpin. I want to look at the opening paragraph. O'Connor is doing what she always does. We're getting much of the story in the first paragraph. The doctor's waiting room, which was very small, was almost full when the Turpins entered, and Mrs. Turpin, who was very large, made it look even smaller by her presence. The waiting room is not big enough to contain Mrs. Turpin. She is large in size, she is formidable, and she will make anything around her smaller by her presence. And that physical size is going to be translated as well into Mrs. Turpin's pride. She is a big woman in terms of her pride, and the rest of the world is small when she compares it to herself. She stood looming at the head of the magazine table set in the center of it, a living demonstration that the room was inadequate and ridiculous. Her little bright black eyes took in all the patients as she sized up the seating situation. There was one vacant chair and a place on the sofa occupied by a blonde child in a dirty blue romper who should have been told to move over and make room for the lady. He was 5 or 6, but Mrs. Turpin saw at once that no one was going to tell him to move over. He was slumped down in the seat, his arms idle at his sides, and his eyes idle in his head. His nose ran unchecked. And the paragraph ends with we're suddenly going inside Mrs. Turpin's head, and we're seeing this child from her point of view, and the people in the waiting room are inadequate, the child is dirty, and the child is small, and his nose is running. She is passing judgment instantly on everyone in the room, and especially on this poor, dirty, little 5-year-old kid. And the first thing we get is judgment. And who is the source of judgment? Mrs. Turpin. And what makes her able to judge those around her? She is big and overwhelming, okay? And she immediately takes control. Mrs. Turpin put a firm hand on Claude's shoulder. Claude is her poor husband. And said in a voice that included anyone who wanted to listen, "Claude, you sit in that chair there," and gave him a push down into the vacant one. Claude was florid and bald and sturdy, somewhat shorter than Mrs. Turpin, but he sat down as if he were accustomed to doing what she told him to. Okay. And in the second paragraph, we get the dynamic between wife and husband. Now, why are they there? Because something has happened to Claude physically. They have the farm. He's out with the cows. A cow kicked him. And he's got a purple swelling on his calf. What has brought them in is an action on the part of a dumb animal out on the farm that has hurt Claude physically. What's going to happen in the waiting room is an action from a really mean-spirited human being that's going to hurt Mrs. Turpin physically, but more importantly, spiritually. She's going to get nailed just above her eye. She's going to leave the doctor's waiting room with a mark, the thing that brought Claude in, but that's not really where she's going to get hit. She's going to get hit in her soul. She's going to be nailed there, and it's going to change her life. But before that happens, we run through, it's the idle talk in the waiting room. I can't go through it all. It is brilliant. It is uproariously funny. But let's just look for a moment, top of page 635, to the girl who's going to make this change in Mrs. Turpin. Next to her was a fat girl of 18 or 19, scowling into a thick blue book, which Mrs. Turpin saw was entitled Human Development. Now, the joke, of course, is it's obviously a psychology textbook. We find out later this fat girl's been to college. She's learned the good college lessons to hate the world and everyone and everything around her. And she's not wasting her time, even sitting in the doctor's office, where she apparently has come because of her hideous acne. We'll find that out in a moment. Her face is blotched all over. But she's reading her psychology textbook. That book is going to become the source of human development in Mrs. Turpin. But not because Mrs. Turpin reads the book, but because the book is going to bounce off Mrs. Turpin's head. It's a wonderful little joke. The girl raised her head and directed her scowl at Mrs. Turpin as if she did not like her looks. She appeared annoyed that anyone should speak while she tried to read. The poor girl's face was blue with acne, and Mrs. Turpin thought how pitiful it was to have a face like that at that age. She gave the girl a friendly smile, but the girl only scowled the harder. Mrs. Turpin herself was fat, but she had always had good skin, and though she was 47 years old, there was not a wrinkle in her face except around her eyes from laughing too much. And again, notice, the narrator keeps pulling us into Mrs. Turpin's head, and we're judging the world from Mrs. Turpin's point of view. We're judging Mrs. Turpin's face from Mrs. Turpin's point of view. Exactly. Not a wrinkle in her face except around the eyes, and those were from laughing. They were not crow's feet. They were not crow's feet or wrinkles that came from age. They came from her basic good nature, and she laughed a lot, and therefore she got, unfortunately, a few wrinkles. But that's because of her good disposition, as we keep hearing her praise herself. Now, we run through the rest of the people in the waiting room, and she settles her eyes on the child's mother, who had on a yellow sweatshirt, wine-colored slacks, both gritty looking, and the rims of her lips were stained with snuff. Her dirty yellow hair was tied behind with a little piece of red paper ribbon. Worse than niggers any day, Mrs. Turpin thought. We're in the South in the 50s, and again, we're inside Mrs. Turpin's head, and now as soon as she thinks that, we hear the gospel hymn playing on the radio. I'm still near the bottom of 635. The gospel hymn playing was, "When I looked up and he looked down," and Mrs. Turpin, the last line mentally, "and one of these days I know I'll wear a crown." Now, not only is she the source of all judgment, but her salvation is assured. She is just biding her time in the waiting room until the moment comes that God takes her right up to heaven and Jesus puts the crown on her, because she is the best woman a woman could possibly be, and she is saved. Notice the very next line after the gospel song. Without appearing to, Mrs. Turpin always noticed people's feet. She judges people's shoes. She judges their feet. And we go through this catalog of what all the people in the waiting room are wearing, and she passes judgment on that. She also has exquisite fashion sense, we learn, okay? She can judge the fashions that people are wearing. Very bottom of 635, sometimes at night when she couldn't go to sleep, Mrs. Turpin would occupy herself with the question of who she would have chosen to be if she couldn't have been herself. If Jesus had said to her before he made her, there's only two places available for you, you can either be a nigger or white trash, what would she have said? "Please, Jesus, please," she would have said. "Just let me wait until there's another place available." And he would have said, "No, you have to go right now, and I have only those two places, so make up your mind." She would have wiggled and squirmed and begged and pleaded, but it would have been no use, and finally she would have said, "All right, make me a nigger then. But that don't mean a trashy one." And he would have made her a neat, clean, respectable Negro woman herself, but black. Please notice, in a way, we don't have to discuss the story. We just have to look at what's there. This story is open and it's clear, and you just have to focus on what's there, because O'Connor is giving everything to us. It is, if you will, as clear and direct as a gospel story, as a parable. Only we're getting it in our own time, in a very particular place that Flannery O'Connor knew very well, and that's where we're getting our little lesson, and we're learning everything. She looks back at the ugly girl, top of 637. The ugly girl, they're talking about the clock on the wall. The ugly girl beside her cast an eye upward at the clock, smirked, then looked directly at Mrs. Turpin and smirked again. Then she returned her eyes to her book. She was obviously the lady's daughter, because although they didn't look anything alike as to disposition, they both had the same shape of face and the same blue eyes. On the lady, they sparkled pleasantly, but in the girl's seared face, they appeared alternately to smolder and to blaze. There is fire in these eyes. What if Jesus had said, "All right, you can be white trash or a nigger or ugly"? This is how the woman occupies her thoughts. We look at the girl's eyes again, and Mrs. Turpin sees there, and it's interesting, the girl's eyes seemed lit all of a sudden with a peculiar light, an unnatural light, like night road signs give. She looks, she sees fire. Now she looks, and it's like the glow of those road signs at night when your headlights hit them, coming out of the darkness, okay? These images are interesting. Fire, light, signs. What is going on inside this girl? Well, we're going to learn her name in just a moment. And this ugly, pockmarked, scowling, vicious, mean-spirited, liberally educated college student is named Mary Grace. Now, the joke there, of course, is there is a complete mismatch between the name and this girl that we see. But our own judgments aren't adequate because indeed this girl, Mary Grace, is going to become the source of grace for Mrs. Turpin. And that burning in her eyes, whether she's aware of it or not, and she probably isn't, is that in her anger and resentment, she's going to do God's work. And God is going to take an action of hers and turn it into a source of grace, proving something we all know, that God can take something that is bad and make something good from it. We're going to see that happen in this story. The moral of the story is not that you should go around throwing large textbooks at the heads of pompous elderly women. That is not the message of the story. The message of the story is sometimes it happens and God can turn that into a great good. Before we get there, however, it's wonderful. 638, we learn about their hogs. And the white trash woman, who of course doesn't even have a name. "One thing I don't want," the white trash woman said, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand. "Hogs, nasty stinking things, a grunting and a rooting all over the place." Mrs. Turpin gave her the merest edge of her attention. "Our hogs are not dirty, and they don't stink," she said. "They're cleaner than some children I've seen." We now have open verbal battles going on in the doctor's way. Please notice, what have we got? Indeed, the doctor's waiting room is life itself with all of these sinful, nasty-mouthed, fallen. These do not seem to be particularly evil people, but they're all standing in the need of grace. All of them, okay? "Their feet never touch the ground. We have a pig parlor. That's where you raise them on concrete. And Claude scoots them down with the hose every afternoon and washes off the floor." Cleaner by far than that child right there, she thought. Poor nasty little thing. He had not moved except to put the thumb of his dirty hand into his mouth. Even her hogs are clean, okay? Well, middle of 639, the conversation is hysterical. Read this story aloud to each other sometime. It's a riot. "One thing I know," the white trash woman said, "two things I ain't going to do. Love no niggers or scoot down no hog with no hose." And she let out a bark of contempt. The look that Mrs. Turpin and the pleasant lady exchanged indicated that they both understood that you had to have certain things before you could know certain things. Now, they're talking about possessions that would then elevate you, or manners that would then elevate you, or a bar of soap that would then elevate you. But, of course, what Mrs. Turpin doesn't realize is that you indeed have to have certain things like humility before you can know certain things like who you are and where you stand in the eyes of God. It is very clear Mrs. Turpin is the Pharisee. She is smugly content with herself, and she is content because she is not like other people. Dirty and white trash and niggers and ugly, and she has good deportment and is decent and laughs and is very sweet. Okay, and she's going to go on and keep telling us about all of this. I'll leap ahead. I'm at the top of 642. There's another song playing, a pop tune about how we'll all go together, we'll help each other out, smiling in any kind of weather. Mrs. Turpin didn't catch every word, but she caught enough to agree with the spirit of the song, and it turned her thoughts sober. We now get the philosophical Mrs. Turpin. She never spared herself when she found somebody in need, whether they were white or black, trash or decent. And of all she had to be thankful for, she was most thankful that this was so. If Jesus had said, "You can be high society and have all the money you want and be thin and svelte-like, but you can't be a good woman with it," she would have had to say, "Well, don't make me that then. Make me a good woman, and it don't matter what else, how fat or how ugly or how poor. her heart rose. He had not made her a nigger or white trash or ugly. He had made her herself and given her a little of everything. Jesus, thank you, she said. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Whenever she counted her blessings, she felt as buoyant as if she weighed 125 pounds instead of 180. Now the joke is, it sounds as if it's her fat and gravity pulling her down. Nope, it's her pride. It's her pride, the pride of the Pharisee. The pride of this Pharisee who thinks, you know, I'm not like those other people. I am good. I am good. And that's why I have all these blessings. However, in the midst of all this, two eyes are drilling into her. Through this whole scene, two eyes are drilling into her. Bottom of 642. All at once, the ugly girl turned her lips inside out again. Her eyes were fixed like two drills on Mrs. Turpin. This time, there was no mistaking that there was something urgent behind them. "Girl," Mrs. Turpin exclaimed silently, "I haven't done a thing to you. The girl must be confusing her with somebody else." There was no need to sit by and let herself be intimidated. "You must be in college," she said boldly, looking directly at the girl. "I see you reading a book there." And then we learn that the girl's name is Mary Grace. "The lady asked you a question, Mary Grace." Her mother says, "I have ears," Mary Grace said. She's a lovely child. And then we learn she goes to Wellesley College in Massachusetts. In the summer, she just keeps right on studying. A real bookworm. She's done real well at Wellesley. She's taking English and math and history and psychology and social studies. And I think it's too much. I think she ought to get out and have fun. The girl looked as if she would like to hurl them all through the plate glass window. Please notice what's happening. What? The girl is proud too. She's been to school. She's studying. She doesn't want to sit here with these low types in this. But for some reason, it's Mrs. Turpin that gets to her. Why? Like knows like. Pride knows pride. And that book, Human Development, will become the connecting point between the two of them. All right? They start talking about dispositions. Just to prove that the point keeps being underlined. "I thank the Lord he has blessed me with a good one," Mrs. Turpin said. "The day has never dawned that I couldn't find something to laugh at." "Not since she married me anyways," Claude said with a comical straight face. Everybody laughed except the girl and the white trash. Oh, my. 644, here we go. What Aristotle would call the crisis, the turning point in the story. Everything's been set up for us. Middle of the page. "If it's one thing I am," Mrs. Turpin said with feeling, "it's grateful. When I think who all I could have been besides myself and what I got, a little of everything, and a good disposition besides, I just feel like shouting, thank you, Jesus, for making everything the way it is. It could have been different. For one thing, somebody else could have got clawed." At the thought of this, she was flooded with gratitude, and a terrible pang of joy ran through her. "Oh, thank you, Jesus. Jesus, thank you," she cried aloud. The book struck her directly over her left eye. It struck almost at the same instant that she realized the girl was about to hurl it. Before she could utter a sound, the raw face came crashing across the table toward her, howling. The girl's fingers sank like clamps into the soft flesh of her neck. She heard the mother cry out and Claude shout, "Woo!" There was an instant when she was certain that she was about to be in an earthquake. And she is. The world she lived in is about to collapse. Is about to collapse. The earth is going to shake and bring everything down around her. All at once her vision narrowed and she saw everything as if it were happening in a small room far away. Or as if she were looking at it through the wrong end of a telescope. We get the description, and then suddenly her vision reversed itself and she saw everything large instead of small. Please notice, perspective for the first time. Everything around her, the whole world and her perspective on it is changing. The eyes of the white trashy woman were staring hugely at the floor. I'm at 645, the top. There the girl, held down on one side by the nurse and on the other by her mother, was wrenching and turning in their grasp. The doctor was kneeling astride her, trying to hold her arm down. He managed, after a second, to sink a long needle into it. The girl is mad. She's out of control. It's pride confronting pride. It is looking in a mirror and not being able to bear what you see. Bottom of the page. The girl's eyes stopped rolling and focused on her, on Mrs. Turpin. They seemed a much lighter blue than before, as if a door that had been tightly closed behind them was now open to admit light and air. This is in the girl. What? Well, the drug is working, but also there's now clarity in the look. Mrs. Turpin's head cleared, and her power of motion returned. She leaned forward until she was looking directly into the fierce, brilliant eyes. There was no doubt in her mind that the girl did know her. Knew her in some intense and personal way, beyond time and place and condition. Very top of 646. "What you've got to say to me?" she asked hoarsely, and held her breath, waiting as for a revelation. The girl raised her head, her gaze locked with Mrs. Turpin's. "Go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog," she whispered. Her voice was low but clear. Her eyes burned for a moment as if she saw with pleasure that her message had struck its target. Mrs. Turpin sank back in her chair. After a moment, the girl's eyes closed and she turned her head wearily to the side. The message has been given. You are an old warthog out of hell. Now, it strikes, it lands just as the book did. The physical object nails her, and then the message nails her. Okay? Like the cow kicking clawed, she is wounded. And she is wounded not just with the book, she is wounded with the words. She goes home. She goes home. They're both upset. They go upstairs. They're in the bedroom, Claude with his leg on a pillow. I'm at the bottom of 647, and herself with a damp washcloth over her eye. The instant she was flat on her back, the image of a razor-backed hog with warts on its face and horns coming out behind its ears snorted into her head. She moaned, a low, quiet moan. "I am not," she said tearfully, "a warthog from hell." But the denial had no force. God bless her, she's recognizing a fact. What? That she was indeed piggish in her pride, and that pride was rendering her, was leading her to hell. It's as simple as that. And she's fighting it, but there it is. The girl's eyes and her words, even the tone of her voice, low but clear, directed only to her, brooked no repudiation. She had been singled out for the message, though there was trash in the room to whom it might justly have been applied. And now she's trying to, you know, all those others were more deserving of that message than I was. Why me? The full force of this fact struck her only now. There was a woman there who was neglecting her own child, but she had been overlooked. The message had been given to Ruby Turpin, a respectable, hard-working, church-going woman. The tears dried. Her eyes began to burn instead with wrath. And now the pride turns into anger. And the anger is the anger of the soul that has been forced to see itself clearly in a rage at the truth it's been given. Little moment, tiny moment. This is O'Connor. This makes great art. Claude is going to go out and get the workers to help him in the field. Bottom of 648, she was looking straight up as if there were unintelligible handwriting on the ceiling. It's the writing on the wall, except here it's on the ceiling. if O'Connor counts on some of us, her Catholic writers, to know what that would be. The handwriting on the wall. Except here it's on the ceiling. And indeed, what does the writing say? You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And she may not be a king, but she has certainly thought of herself as a queen. The protuberance over her eye had turned a greenish blue. Listen here, she said. What? Kiss me. Claude leaned over and kissed her loudly on the mouth. He pinched her side and their hands interlocked. It's a lovely little moment. She's hurting. She's in pain. And she turns to her husband, who has seemed to be a doofus up till now, but now becomes rather charming. He loves his wife. There's a little moment of human connection there. It's a hopeful sign. It is a hopeful sign. Her expression of ferocious concentration did not change. Claude got up, groaning and growling, and limped off. She continued to study the ceiling. Now, the men come to work in the fields, and the black women are in the truck, and the black women ask what happened to her eye. She starts to tell them, and they won't believe it. Oh, no, you must have just fallen down. And then she goes on and tells them the story of what happened to her in the waiting room. I'm at the top of 650. She tells them the girl struck her, the girl yelled at her, they carried her off in the ambulance. You know what she said to me, top of 650? What she say, they asked. She said, Mrs. Turpin began and stopped, her face very dark and heavy. The sun was getting whiter and whiter, blanching the sky overhead so that the leaves of the hickory tree were black in the face of it. She could not bring forth the words. Something real ugly, she muttered. She sure shouldn't say nothing ugly to you, the old woman said. You're so sweet, you're the sweetest lady I know. She pretty too, the one with the hat on said. And stout, the other one said. I never know no sweeter white lady. That's the truth before Jesus, the old woman said. Amen. You just as sweet and pretty as you can be. Mrs. Turpin knew just exactly how much Negro flattery was worth, and it added to her rage. She will not take false compliments now. The pride is being drained out of her. And she won't allow herself to be pumped up with pride by phony compliments. She said, she began again and finished this time with a fierce rush of breath, that I was an old warthog from hell. There was an astounded silence. Where is she at? The youngest woman cried in a piercing voice. Let me see her. I'll kill her. I'll kill her with you, the other one cried. She belong in an asylum, the old woman said emphatically. You're the sweetest white lady I know. She pretty too, the other two said. Stout as she can be and sweet. Jesus satisfied with her. Dee Dee is, the old woman declared. Idiots, Mrs. Turpin growled to herself. You could never say anything intelligent to a nigger. You could talk at them, but not with them. And she gets out of there. She's changing. She's changing. But she's still not there because she's still judgmental. Still, she won't believe the compliments anymore, but she has to still insult the others. She has to still hurl abuse at the others. She tries to go back in the kitchen. The protuberance over her eye looked like a miniature tornado cloud, which might any moment sweep across the horizon of her brow. It's a wonderful image. Her lower lip protruded dangerously. Remember the last lower lip that protruded dangerously? We're getting another link with Mary Grace. The two are very similar. She squared her massive shoulders. Then she marched into the front of the house and out the side door and started down the road to the pig parlor. She had the look of a woman going single-handed, weaponless, into battle. Where is she going and what is she going to do? She's going down to clean the hogs. And she goes down to the pig parlor. She goes down to the pig parlor, grabs the hose away from Claude, tells him to take those workers home. Claude just says, you look like you might have swallowed a mad dog. but he goes, okay? 6:52. She's spraying the stream of water at the hindquarters of any shoat that looked as if it might try to lie down. She's taking the anchor out of the pigs. But at the same time, what's she doing? She's cleaning them. Because they've been in the mud and they need cleaning. And what is happening, of course, very simply, is that as she cleans the pigs' bodies, God is cleaning her soul. And we've got a whole lot. We've got the human creature cleaning the animals and the divine cleaning the fallen human creature. It's a beautiful moment. Simple as can be. Simple as could be. But Mrs. Turpin doesn't want to be cleaned, and her battle is not with the hogs, it's with God, and she engages in a debate. "What do you send me a message like that for?" she said in a low, fierce voice, barely above a whisper, but with the force of a shout in its concentrated fury. "How am I a hog and me both? How am I saved and from hell too?" And there's the question. She knows she's a saved woman, but now she's just been told she's from hell. This doesn't seem possible. Her free fist was knotted, and with the other she gripped the hose, blindly pointing the stream of water in and out of the eye of the old sow, whose outraged squeal she did not hear. And now she is hitting the eye of the outraged female pig, just as the book hit her eye. But she doesn't hear the cry of the pig, it's just an animal, but please notice we have kind of a repeated action going on here. Everything is being cleaned up and squealing while it happens. "Why me?" she rumbled. "It's no trash around here, black or white, that I haven't given to and break my back to the bone every day working and do for the church, and this is undoubtedly all true. This is undoubtedly all true." Her problem is not in the area of these charitable works she does. Her problem is pride. She appeared to be the right-sized woman to command the arena before her. "How am I a hog?" she demanded. "Exactly how am I like them?" And she jabbed the stream of water at the shouts. "There was plenty of trash there. It didn't have to be me. If you like trash, better go get yourself some trash then," she wailed. "You could have made me trash or a nigger. If trash is what you wanted, why didn't you make me trash?" She shook her fist with the hose in it, and a watery snake appeared momentarily in the air. And there's that old snake, only we're not in a garden. We're in the pig parlor. "I could quit working and take it easy and be filthy," she growled. Notice this. What's her anger with God? How does it come out? "I can be worse than I am." "You try to tell me something, you make me learn a lesson. Okay, I can be worse than, I'll show you how bad I can be. I could quit working and take it easy and be filthy," she growled. "Lounge about the sidewalks all day drinking root beer. Dip snuff and spit in every puddle and have it all over my face. I could be nasty, or you could have made me a nigger. It's too late for me to be a nigger," she said with deep sarcasm. "But I could act like one, lay down in the middle of the road and stop traffic. Roll on the ground." And the pride just keeps billowing up. Okay? But of course, as that hose keeps cleaning the pigs, God's grace keeps working on her soul. In the deepening light, everything was taking on a mysterious hue. The pasture was growing a peculiar glassy green, and the streak of highway had turned lavender. This ordinary world's becoming almost magical. Something is happening. She braced herself for a final assault, and this time her voice rolled out over the pasture. "Gone!" she yelled. "Call me a hog! Call me a hog again from hell! Call me a warthog from hell! Put that bottom rail on top! There'll still be a top and bottom!" It's wonderful. Social position, social rank, it's Southern. A garbled echo returned to her. A final surge of fury shook her, and she roared, "Who do you think you are?" And there you have the piggish pride in the heart of man standing up to challenge God. You've heard this before. It's my favorite Solzhenitsyn line. Pride grows on the human heart like lard on a pig. And O'Connor's making that same connection. But what do? You wash those pigs down. You get the mud off them. And that's happening to Mrs. Turpin. The color of everything, field and crimson sky, burned for a moment with a transparent intensity. The question carried over the pasture and across the highway and the cotton field and returned to her clearly like an answer from beyond the wood. She opened her mouth, but no sound came out of it. God has shut her up. Her last moment is to ask God, "Who do you think you are?" And he answers, and she is silent. And the pride is broken, and a humble, silent woman stands there. Mrs. Turpin stood there, her gaze fixed on the highway, all her muscles rigid, until in 5 or 6 minutes the truck reappeared, returning. She waited until it had time to turn into their own road, then like a monumental statue coming to life, she bent her head slowly and gazed, as if through the very heart of mystery, down into the pig parlor at the Hogs. They had settled all in one corner around the old sow, who was grunting softly. A red glow suffused them. They appeared to pant with a secret life. The pigs are clean and content. Until the sun slipped finally behind the tree line, Mrs. Turpin remained there with her gaze bent to them as if she were absorbing some abysmal life-giving knowledge. At last she lifted her head. There was only a purple streak in the sky, cutting through a field of crimson and leading like an extension of the highway into the descending dusk. She raised her hands from the side of the pen in a gesture hieratic and profound. A visionary light settled in her eyes. She saw the streak as a vast swinging bridge extending upward from the earth through a field of living fire. Upon it, a vast horde of souls were rumbling toward heaven. There were whole companies of white trash, clean for the first time in their lives, and bands of black niggers in white robes, and battalions of freaks and lunatics, shouting and clapping and leaping like frogs. And bringing up the end of the procession was a tribe of people whom she recognized at once as those who, like herself and Claude, had always had a little of everything and the God-given wit to use it right. She leaned forward to observe them closer. They were marching behind the others with great dignity, accountable as they had always been for good order and common sense and respectable behavior. They alone were on key, yet she could see by their shocked and altered faces that even their virtues were being burned away. What is this poor, proud Protestant woman who is now gaining some measure of humility seeing? Purgatory. Purgatory. Fire burning away the sins of all these souls. Imagine what a revelation it is to a woman who said, "How can I be going to heaven and be out of hell at the same time?" Well, honey, it's very simple. Now that you've learned humility, you still have to go through the fires of purgatory. This is the first presentation of purgatory I know in literature since Dante. It's very simple, it's very direct, and she uses his main image at the top of Mount Purgatory, the fire, the wall of fire that all those souls have to walk through. And what does she see? Her virtues being burned away. Well, she has to learn they weren't virtues. God's not going to burn away the virtues. Something else is going to be burned away. Her understanding is not yet complete, but she has been given the vision and she's been humbled. There's a good chance she'll get there because of Mary Grace and the throne book and the change in her heart and the cleaning up process that has to go on and the vision she's been given. She lowered her hands and gripped the rail of the hog pen, her eyes small but fixed unblinkingly on what lay ahead. In a moment, the vision faded, but she remained where she was, immobile. At length, she got down and turned off the faucet and made her slow way on the darkening path to the house. Not easy to suddenly believe in purgatory in the Protestant South. Just think what she's got ahead of her. In the woods around her, the invisible cricket choruses had struck up, but what she heard were the voices of the souls climbing upward into the starry field and shouting hallelujah. It's amazing. O'Connor made the final corrections on this story in the hospital shortly before she died. She finished up two other stories in the hospital. And the nurses kept taking the paper and the writing implements away from her, and her friends, God bless them, would smuggle them back in because she knew if she only had a little time left, she wanted to get a few last stories down. That's a commitment to Catholic art. And that's a commitment to giving us something special through literature that we otherwise wouldn't have. And God be praised, he let her live long enough to finish those stories. But he also permitted her to suffer, because I'm sure she knew better than anyone that her own soul needed some hosing down and some burning off. She would have been the first to admit it, as is the case with all of us. But God has been kind enough to us to grant us a kind of vision that much of the rest of the world doesn't have. And it's appropriate that we end this summer's book camp with the vision of the cricket choruses that are really the voices of souls, and the knowledge that it is possible for the natural and the supernatural to join together and be one again through the grace of God that works in the most mysterious ways. Thank you.